I just wanted us to consider this morning, together, just how cute my son is. Isn't he cute? If you disagree, you're wrong, of course. But I wanted to begin with the shortened version of the story of how he was born. And this is actually one of the more distressing moments in my life, and I wasn't even the one giving birth. And it was distressing because it was long. Like, we were there from Thursday, December 4th. He was born Saturday evening, December 6th. And then we didn't leave until Monday night. So it was long. But it was also distressing because nothing went to plan. We weren't planning to get an inducement, but on a routine checkup on her progress, her blood pressure was really high, so upon their suggestion, we went over, and we did. And she wasn't planning on getting an epidural, but the inducement was so ineffective, it caused early labor, and that went on for so long, and then by the time active labor came, she got the epidural. And we weren't planning on getting a C-section either. But we did, because Elijah was comfortable in there, and his blood pressure was getting really high, and Jerusha was running a fever. So upon their suggestion, we did. It was also quite distressing, because, you know, I didn't have any control over the situation. There wasn't a whole lot that I could do about it. But it does end on a good note. We were able to hear his first cry. He came out all right. He was a little cone-headed, but, you know, after we dropped him a couple times, that fixed itself. I'm just kidding. We haven't dropped him yet. but now he's a grown boy, and he's interested in his feet. So he's doing good. But I look back on that time, and in reflection, I realize my focus was a lot more on myself, you know, what I could do, what I should be doing, what I couldn't be doing. And I realized, looking back on it, I kind of settled for myself in some ways as kind of a shallow substitute for God. My trust was more in myself in that moment. I didn't quite pray as much as I should have. I didn't really entrust that whole process as much as I could have to God. And, you know, there are other ways in my life, and even currently, where I put my trust in shallow substitutes for God as well, for relief, for security, for satisfaction. There are seasons where I'm really lacking in frequency of prayer, which does demonstrate where my dependence more is. Sometimes my security is more my hope for security is more in the size of my savings account than it is in the size of my God. Sometimes my satisfaction, my overall joy in life about if things are going good, are more anchored in comfort or hobbies or entertainment rather than in my relationship with the Lord. But I think sometimes we may do this too. Maybe sometimes we settle for shallow substitutes for God to give us relief, security, and satisfaction. Maybe sometimes we don't pray when we're facing distress, and instead we're more focused on our own efforts and our own capabilities and our own resources. Maybe we put too much hope in our finances or our career or success for security. Maybe we anchor our joy too much in something circumstantial like comfort or fitness or our overall prosperity. Well, today we're taking a look at Psalm 4, and we're going to learn how David shows us how he demonstrates a right response to distress as he faces the distress of a drought, and how he demonstrates his trust in God alone for relief, for joy, and security and satisfaction instead of any sort of shallow substitute. And so my central charge for you today is to trust in God for relief from distress not in shallow substitutes. Trust in God for relief from distress, not in shallow substitutes. So let's take a look at Psalm 4, and we're going to read through that. That should be page 559 in your Red Pew Bible. I'll give you a second to turn there if you're not there already. Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have given me relief when I was in distress. Be gracious to me and hear my prayer. O men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. There are many who say, who will show us some good? Lift up the light of your face upon us, O Lord. You have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. You guys can go ahead and switch the slide. Thank you. I actually think this picture was one that Pastor Banks had used in a recent sermon. And I think it illustrates well of needing relief. And that's why you'll never catch me doing anything like this. Cave climbing and, you know, fitting in small spaces, that's really claustrophobic for me. But it really illustrates well the idea of being trapped, needing relief. And, you know, David is turning to God for relief, to free him from the things that are tying him down, for the things that are causing him distress. In verse 1, this is the first section of this psalm, the central charge, takeaway from this is to turn to God for relief and not yourself. And this is something David highlights. He highlights that the first shallow substitute for relief amidst distress is ourselves. And he first, when facing distress, he shifts his attention to God. And he demonstrates his trust in God to find relief. The word there for relief actually carries with it the idea of being enlarged, being widened, being freed, which is probably something this guy would really want, but something that David was turning to God for entrusting him in. This psalm comes right after Psalm 3, which is the last psalm that I preached on, which was about Absalom's betrayal. And he's likely thinking of, you, God, you are the God who gave me relief from that distress. Please now give me relief from this distress. So what distress is he facing here in this psalm? Well, some people think that it is the same context, that it has to do with the conspiracy that Absalom was bringing upon him. But I actually think that the context better fits in 2 Samuel 21, after Absalom's conspiracy, him and the nation of Israel were facing a drought, and they were facing a famine. I think verse 6 kind of keys us into that. And so David, knowing that God has given him relief from the distress of a betrayal from his own son and running for his life in the wilderness, he's now turning to God to give him relief from the distress of facing a drought as the king of Israel. But David also trusts God to find justice. Right in the beginning there of this introductory plea, he says, O God of my righteousness. And that's because he trusts God to vindicate him or to show that he is right in this matter. As a king, back then, many people would blame the king for the state of things. I think we still do that with our leaders today. But they blamed him especially for this famine, saying, who will show us some good? Saying he's completely at fault that there's no prosperity at the moment. And so in some ways he's confronting the Israelites who think that the better solution is to turn to other gods, to commit idolatry, to put their trust in the things that they used to, that they've carved out of the same wood that they've used to cook their food. So the Lord is saying, or David is saying to God, he's trusting in him to show that he is right, that his faith is rightly placed in the one true God. But he also trusts God to find help, or in other words, to be heard. David has, he starts, his first words are such a bold cry, stating in the imperative, "Answer me when I call," and ends that plea with, "Be gracious to me and hear my prayer." And that's because he already knew that God would hear him, much in the same way that God answered him in Psalm 3. Now, at first glance, many psalms enter with this kind of typical call to God, and sometimes we can kind of gloss over these. But we should remember that such a plea and such a one as this one demonstrates dependence on God. And that's where David is starting. His attention is on God when he's facing distress. So that encourages us and should convict us that when we face distress, that we should turn to God for relief instead of ourselves. And perhaps we get so focused on our abilities and resources and strength that we just fail to remember that we need to be leaning and depending on God instead of leaning and depending on ourselves. And I think maybe this is something we should ask ourselves as a church. Perhaps our trust is more in our ability to organize our programs instead of resting solely and wholly on God to establish our ministry here. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, and maybe it could depend on the day. But I think a good practice that we should consider is perhaps making a more frequent practice of prayer before starting any program, before starting any activity that we're doing, entrusting that to the Lord to establish our plans. Now, I've personally been convicted by this. I know there's a lot of things that I do, and I don't entrust it to God. Even something like driving, sometimes speaking or eating, meeting with someone, leaving the house or going to sleep. These are all opportunities for us to put our trust in the Lord. And so in verse 1, David demonstrates that we should be trusting in God with our distress instead of ourselves. And in verses 2 to 5, David demonstrates that we should be putting our hope in God instead of lies or idols. If you draw your attention to the screen for a second, there should be a picture that'll come up here shortly. I was just wondering if, I'm asking for audience participation here, if anybody can guess what this is supposed to illustrate. If you got it, just feel free to shout it out. House on the Rocks, very good. Yes, if you could tell that black foundation there is the rock, and on the right there, that's supposed to be the house that was built on the sand. It was very, very a wonderful piece of art. I actually have a second picture with that is less artistic, but I think it illustrates well what David is getting at here in verses 2 to 5. David is exposing his people's misplaced trust. They are trusting in idols, not in the rock. They're trusting in images carved out of wood, not in the one true God, as they are facing this drought. And so David highlights that the second shallow substitute that perhaps sometimes we may turn to, and that they were turning to amidst this distress, are lies or idols. He goes from shifting his attention to God, and now he's shifted his attention to the people. He's talking to them now during his prayer. This prayer was actually written to be sung in public. And so this is kind of addressing the people directly about their idolatry. He warns the people in verses 2 to 3. He starts off with a rhetorical question, "How long? How long will you turn my honor into shame?" By this he means, "How long will you blame me for this drought when I am not at fault?" And he truly wasn't at fault. If you look at the context in 2 Samuel 21, it was actually Saul's fault for the drought. He broke a covenant with the Gibeonites, and the text reveals that that's why they were experiencing the drought, not because of David's lack of action or administrative failure as king. But this could also be taken as, how long will you turn my honor, as in referring to God, into shame with your idolatry? I think both fit. He also follows with another rhetorical question, how long? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? The term vain words in the Hebrew refers to the idea of vapor. It's vain. And he's saying your words are like vapor. They don't accomplish anything. They rise into the air and turn into mist and disappear. Their prayers to their fake gods have not accomplished anything amidst this drought. And that's because it's a lie. Idolatry is a lie. To think that we can take something that our Creator created and turn it into the Creator and put our trust in that, that is a lie. Their idols can't provide them relief from distress. Only God can. And so David follows in contrast. He uses himself as a contrast. He says, the Lord has set apart the godly. Or in other words, he treats them with special favor. And in that, he means God hears them. And specifically, David, when they call. So they've misplaced their trust in a shallow substitute, in an idol. They've trusted in lies instead of God, whereas David reminds them they should be calling on the one true God who can actually change their situation, their plight. And so naturally, as we move on to verse 4, David advises his people to respond better to their emotions that are sparked by this drought. He recognizes that they're trembling with anger. And that word anger carries with it the idea of trembling. They're trembling with anger, and they're angry because they're experiencing a drought. They don't have enough food for their families. There's a lack of security, lack of nourishment. And again, they're holding David responsible. They're angry. But he tells them that they can be angry. Be angry. But he warns them, don't sin. Do not sin in your anger. And instead, they should ponder or speak to themselves in their own hearts, silently on their bed. Instead of praying to idols or unhelpfully criticizing him about their circumstances. And then he ends this section in verse 5 with a call to return to the Lord. He simply charges them to offer right sacrifices instead of offering sacrifices to idols. And he also charges them to put their trust in Yahweh instead of these lifeless idols. So David's actions here are not just applicable to biblical idolatry like and concerning carved images, but I think they're also applicable to modern forms of idolatry as well. A New City Catechism is the teaching curriculum that we use for our children's midweek program. Maybe some of your kids actually know the answer to this question. But question 17 asks, what is idolatry? And the answer is, idolatry is trusting in created things rather than the Creator for our hope, happiness, significance, and security. Idolatry doesn't just refer to the worship of idols, but it refers to when you allow your heart to cling to anything that isn't the Lord for your hope, happiness, significance, and security. And I think this passage should cause us as Christians to consider what modern idols could be capturing our hearts. What could we be settling for shallow substitutes when we face distress? And perhaps a few that we could name, and a few that we could be building our house on the sand of, would be wealth, fitness, popularity, maybe knowledge, success, family, medication, or maybe even the church. I personally know that when I'm distressed and I want to escape that distress, I instinctively can turn to fitness or entertainment. I know that using big words sometimes makes me sound smart, and it makes me feel better about myself and more competent. And I know that sometimes I put too much hope into being seen as a godly person when really I'm nothing but a sinner saved by grace who's sharing that message with you all. C.S. Lewis observes that we have a God-shaped hole within each of us. And we need to recognize when we are attempting to fill that hole with created things instead of the Creator. And so we should ask the same question that David asks. How long will we settle for these shallow substitutes? How long are we going to put our hope in lies? It is a lie to say that any of these things were ever meant to bring us or ever could bring us enduring satisfaction and security or relief from distress. We should know that God will hear us amidst our distress and that we shouldn't be turning to created things for relief. So in verses 2 to 5, David shows us that we ought to be putting our hope in God and not in lies. And in verses 6 through 8, David shows us that we ought to anchor our satisfaction in God and not our circumstances. And then you can go one more slide, too. There should be another picture. Yep. And there's something about this picture that kind of just makes me feel content. I don't know if any of you may feel the same way, but there's some kind of innate satisfaction with being indoors and looking out the window while it's like pouring down rain outside, especially when it's pouring down hard. And I think this is especially because you know that you have the house giving you protection, and it's not going anywhere. Now, in our passage, I believe that David has found a similar satisfaction. He knows that though the storm of drought is raining down hard on his nation and on himself, he's ultimately protected. His satisfaction is anchored in the Lord because he knows God, and he knows that God is ultimately in control. And in verses 6 through 8, he highlights that the third shallow substitute for relief amidst distress is our circumstances. David here finally shifts his attention from God to his people, and now it's back to God. David demonstrates that his satisfaction and his security are anchored in the Lord and not his circumstances, like whether he is prosperous or not. He first redefined what good means in verses 6 to 7. He quotes the people. They're saying, there are many who say, who will show us some good? And by good, they mean grain and wine and prosperity in general. And what they're really doing is they're criticizing David for the state of their nation. You know, where's all the food gone? Why aren't we prospering? What are you doing that has caused all this to come upon us? And now, regardless of whose fault it is, David responds very patiently and biblically and joyfully to these criticisms. He recalls the blessing of Aaron given to the sons of to the people of Israel. And he asks God, he kind of repeats the blessing. He says, shine your face upon them to bless them. He's recognizing the Lord as the one who ultimately provides and the one who ultimately takes away. And he reveals that he has received joy from simply knowing the Lord. And he's received more joy from his relationship with God than any sort of time of prosperity. And he was able to have satisfaction because his satisfaction, his joy, wasn't anchored in his circumstances, in his prosperity, in how much grain he had and how much wine he had. And then he ends the psalm showing that he has peace amidst this distress that is rooted from God. So he started off with his distress. Lord, you have helped me from distress before. Please help me now to now peace. He can have peace, and it's because his peace is rooted in the Lord. He says he will lie down and sleep in peace. Now, this naturally calls our mind back to Psalm 3, which there's a similar statement of confidence amidst his troubles and anxieties. And back then, in that psalm, he could sleep confidently and safely and securely because of his relationship with Yahweh. And for the same reasons, he can again sleep peacefully or undisturbed in the midst of this drought because he knows that the Lord makes him dwell in safety. He knows that the Lord is the one who's brought this drought. And he knows that the Lord can just as easily take it away. And so David's God anchored joy and peace, I think, should challenge us to anchor our joy and our peace and our security in God and not our circumstances. I think we should recognize that God ultimately determines who prospers or how much we are prospering right now or how much comfort and time we have on our hands in the moment. I think we should redefine the definition of good as knowing God, as having a relationship with God. And we should consider also if we are experiencing the peace of security in the Lord or if we ought to be bringing more of our anxieties to Him. Reading this and reflecting on this has challenged me to consider the question, if removed, what would challenge my overall satisfaction and joy in life? In other words, would I still be content if the nice things in my life were removed? If I didn't have a TV or a gaming system or a comfy bed or a working AC or a body that can move well, would I still be overall satisfied? Would I still say my life is good? Would my relationship with the Lord be enough to say that? And if not, perhaps I've anchored my joy far too much in these circumstantial things. And perhaps that reveals, if that's where my joy is, that's what I treasure. I treasure these things, these circumstantial things, the grain and wine as they were, more than the Lord. And I think this is a question that we as a church should also consider. Is our overall satisfaction what we consider good as our ministry, as TBC, is that anchored in how full the room is? Is that anchored in how high our giving numbers are? Is that anchored in how smooth our service feels or how good the live stream works? If we have a PowerPoint, how much we get done, the manner in which we do outreach, if we have Tab Express, if removed or changed, or if any of these don't fit our expectations, will we be dissatisfied with our ministry as a whole? I mean, I'm not saying it's sinful to care about having more people in here. That's a good thing. Or more consistent giving, or smoother services, or better presentation, or better execution. But if we are treasuring evangelism, discipleship, teaching the Word of God, worship, and ministering to our community and to the world, then we shouldn't feel like our church is failing if the numbers aren't high. We shouldn't feel like our church is failing if the room is less than full, or if our live stream isn't perfect, or if we have some details to smooth out. Now, this isn't a call to apathy, but it's a call to examine where our treasure, what we are really treasuring, where our satisfaction is really anchored in, and a call to treasure what really, truly matters, our faithfulness to the Lord. Our focus and heart should be on faithfulness, our relationship with God. We should yearn to hear the words, "Well done, my good and faithful servants," not "Well done, my good and popular servants." "Well done, my good and well put together servants." "Well done, my good and tech savvy servants." "Well done, my good and faithful servants." So let's not settle for these shallow substitutes. We should examine if our satisfaction is more anchored in them than in our faithfulness to the Lord. Let's anchor our satisfaction in knowing, enjoying, and loving God with all of our beings. So I want to ask you, have you been settling for shallow substitutes? David shows us a right response to distress as he responds to the distress of a drought by trusting solely in God, not himself, by calling others to, to put their hope in God and not lifeless idols, not lifeless lies. And by anchoring his satisfaction and security in the Lord and not his circumstances. I want to say that the world offers many shallow substitutes that seem to offer relief, joy, security. But true relief, joy, security that are worth trusting are only found in Jesus Christ. And we can be confident to find relief because of our relationship with Jesus Christ, because Christ hears our plea, because Christ is our confidence. And we can be truly satisfied in life, whether we have plenty or whether we are in need, similar to Paul, because Christ provides the satisfaction of being blessed by him, of being able to be faithful to him, and having salvation in him alone by his shed blood. And so we can also truly be at peace when we're faced with distress because Christ is Lord over all of our changing circumstances, and he can change any problem that we face. So don't settle for shallow substitutes. Trust in Christ. And this week, I want to encourage you to trust in God for relief amidst distress and not in shallow substitutes, specifically by identifying one shallow substitute that you could be turning for relief, for joy, for security, and for satisfaction that could be stealing your trust and your faith. And consider what it might mean this week to turn away from that and turn back to God. Let's pray.